Thank you very much, Caroline. Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s. It has a mission to inspire debate on important civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, InForum. I am Janet Ray Dupree. I'm moderating this evening. Tonight, we are here to talk about personal genomic testing. The analysis of DNA, basically getting a personal genome map, is now available for less than $400. The consequences of personal genetic testing is often debated. Advocates argue that genetic data can lead to improved health care, but critics warn of potential privacy violations or causing undue worry among consumers after they get the results of the testing. California regulations do impose conditions on firms providing personal genomic testing. Tonight, we'll discuss with several of the key leaders in the industry. We'll discuss the technology, the ramifications of that technology, government regulation of the industry, and the implications for individuals of having their genome analyzed. Tonight, we're hosting Linda Avey, who is co-founder of a leading personal genome testing company called 23andMe. Daniel Ballin, who is a senior fellow in technology studies at the Pacific Research Institute. David Magnus, who is associate professor and director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University School of Medicine. And Mark Gerstein, who is the Albert Williams Professor of Biomedical Informatics, Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry, Computer Science at Yale University. So I think what we're going to get started is with Mark. Mark Gerstein is our panel scientist, and I think it's important for us to understand how we got where we are and what exactly we're talking about when we're talking about personal genomic testing. So, Mark, can you give us an overview?
Sure thing. So I think I'll just start out just giving a quick overview of some of the scientific ideas, and we'll start a long time ago. In the 19th century, one of the big, I think, innovations was people came up with the idea of kind of units of heredity or genes. Maybe you've all heard of Mendel. He came up with this idea. Initially, they were abstract entities. But in the last century, in the 20th century, one of the major triumphs of biological science is that it associated these genes with a molecule, and that's DNA. And it actually, they figured out how this molecule worked. You probably all heard of the double helix and so forth, which was unraveled about 50 or so years ago. And then in the latter half of last century, people realized, well, actually, this is such an important molecule. Maybe we should kind of completely unravel its code for human beings and for other organisms. And so in the 1990s, due to some advances in technology I'll describe in a second, people started sequencing genomes. And essentially at the turn of the millennium, around 2000, quite fittingly, they finished sequencing the human genome. They had a kind of representative human genome sequenced. And one thing that was quite amazing is that the technology that went behind this, essentially there's two types. One is this sequencing technology where you kind of decode the molecule of the genome, and also computer technology that lets you analyze it. Because these things have been progressing so rapidly, in the last 10 years, we've had this idea that in addition to kind of sequencing a representative human genome and decoding that, we could actually sequence the genomes of actually every individual person. And really understand them. And so this has led to this new field that we're now talking about called personal genomics. And you might say, well, why do I need my genome unraveled if I have a representative human genome? And it's because one of the really interesting things about your genome, it's your blueprint of your identity, and the variations that people have between their genomes really are give rise to the variations between people in a very fundamental sense. And so right now, we're kind of at the sort of dawn of an era where we're going to have a lot of genomes unraveled. And there's sort of two main things people kind of think about when they look at the genome. One is they try to associate particular variants in the genome, whether they're a particular what's called nucleotide or base change or a bigger region, with a particular condition a person might have, if they get sick, if they're tall, and so forth. And also they try to more fundamentally annotate the genome and just understand how it's functioning, what molecules it's coding for, and so forth. And those are the two big processes towards understanding it. And I think that gives most of the scientific
background. That's great. Thank you very much. Linda, as a co-founder of 23andMe, Where are we going with all of this? Why does 23andMe exist? And what do you see happening down the road?
Well, the reason we wanted to start the company really had to do with what we thought was sort of the lack of progress in getting toward a world where we have personalized medicine, personalized healthcare. We still are very much, we think, in some cases back in the 18th century, really, with how doctors are able to diagnose disease. And certainly drugs we take, it's a little bit of a crapshoot of whether it's going to work or not for you personally. And I've been working in the field for about 25 years of seeing this technology develop, and a lot of it actually happened right here in the Bay Area, where we developed the ability to sequence the genome and then to go in and probe the genome very precisely with the use of these SNPs, and we can measure these SNPs now in people very accurately and very with a very high quality. And so our ability to do this now is really getting us to a point where we can start to understand our own personal genomes in a way that could affect how our doctors can treat us, how they can prescribe the right medicines to us, diagnose very accurately the diseases we have. And but before we can get there, we need way more data. We need way more information, and that was the slow part we were frustrated with.
Yeah, I'm just going to stop you for one moment. SNPs is SNPS, and that stands for Mark.
Oh, just one second. So to explain a SNP, our genome consists of 3 billion bases, or actually, it's two copies of 3 billion bases. You can think of it as 3 billion letters. And a SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. It's the change of one of those letters between, say, two people. And you can have that type of variation between people, or you can have blocks, which are called copy number variations, in varying between people.
Yeah. So I didn't let you get into where we're headed.
Yeah, so the idea behind our company is that we enable individuals to get access to their genome, and what our engineers and our team and our science team do is they really break that down at a level where lay people who don't have a science background can really start to understand what does this mean for me personally. And we're not judgmental about the information we serve up to our customers. We cover the gamut from your ancestry. We give a lot of information about that, as well as your health and traits, based on where we are with the research right now. So we translate that. If a big paper comes out in Science or Nature, we break it down, explain it, and then try to give you an idea of what it means for you personally. But we do try to put it in the proper light that a lot of this is very early. We're still in the midst of trying to figure these things out. But as we're getting closer and closer to a better understanding, our hope is that people will now be able to go into their doctor armed with this information, and if we can all come together and start educating each other about this, we're going to be at a point where we do think that genetics will inform medicine. But what we need is data. It just keeps going back to that problem that we can't understand why you would do well on a drug and I don't until we have about 1,000 people on these drugs or more in order to figure out, you know, why do you get muscle wasting on a statin and you don't? That's something we just don't know yet. But once we can break these things down, then we're very hopeful that we will get to a point where we not only have personalized health care, but we have preventive health care. We understand in advance the diseases we might get and be able to prevent them if possible.
Okay. Now, David Magnus, I was wondering, is this something that a medical professional should recommend everyone do, or is it way too early? Is there any value in this?
Yeah, actually, most physicians who are knowledgeable in this area at this point say it's far too premature for this to really have much value, and that's because of one of the big sort of shock and surprises has been that with something called genome-wide association studies, which is where you use those SNPs to try and identify the genetic causes of common diseases. So most of genetics up until fairly recently really focused on what are called linkage studies, where they have to have Mendelian diseases in the family. So they're really rare diseases where the genes are very powerful. And the hope with this new genomics was that we would be able to use all these SNPs with large databases to identify the common genes that cause things like heart disease and other kinds of illnesses, to understand height, to understand a lot of the very common traits. And everybody assumed that there would be, because those are what are called complex traits, we knew there would be a number of genes in each of them, but people thought there would be a manageable number and they would be able to understand what causes these kinds of traits. What's happened is we've succeeded in identifying a very large number of genes that are associated and well confirmed for association with type 2 diabetes, for heart disease, which are on the tests from companies like 23andMe and other companies. But it's turned out that they are incredibly weak causally, that they really don't contribute very much. And it looks like it's probably not just a small number of genes, but maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands, maybe even almost all of the genome, it's hard to know at this point, that are really involved in producing almost all of these different traits. Or maybe there are some very rare variants so that what causes heart disease in one person is very different from what causes heart disease in somebody else. We're not really sure what explains these differences, but what it means is even though you see a lot of newspaper headlines and even though you may get a test that tells you you've got a lot of genes associated with heart disease, they actually don't really predict anything and aren't of any clinical value at all. They're interesting scientifically because they tell us about pathways that might be useful for understanding the disease, but they're of no real clinical value. And so when you have these tests, you've got a mix of things from things that are Mendelian sort of diseases that are well confirmed that are important clinically, along with a lot of these traits which look like they're significant. You have, you know, six genes associated with heart disease or type 2 diabetes, but really have absolutely no clinical value. And it's asking an awful lot for people to really understand that, because I'm assuming that probably most of you aren't spending a lot of your time thinking about odds ratios or as part of your everyday life and thinking about these things. So a lot of us are very worried that these things will be misunderstood, misinterpreted, and that's one of the reasons why we think it's important to have appropriate regulation for this, but in fact it's taking place in an almost entirely regulatory vacuum.
Ah, and that's a wonderful segue to Daniel Ballin, who can, as a senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute, he has become more and more familiar with what we need to do to make sure that this, that public policy evolves in such a way that the information remains useful to the individual who has requested the information and doesn't get out there in the wild in public. So can you tell me a little bit about the public policy sphere?
All right, so there is a public policy story here around what we've been discussing, which is that last summer, the Department of Public Health, a state regulatory agency here in California, essentially heard some of the concerns that David was talking about and issued a cease and desist order to 23andMe and Navigenics in California, as well as 11 other companies, telling them that if they wanted to continue to conduct business within the state, they needed to abide by two conditions. One, they needed to be licensed as a clinical laboratory, which somewhat strange because these companies are not actually acting as clinical laboratories. They're not performing the test themselves. What they're doing is sending them to licensed clinical laboratories to perform the test. The other slightly more controversial thing that the state required was that every patient or customer needs to go through a physician in order to engage these services. And this raised a lot of backlash, and it was the subject of a lot of discussion. And the Department of Public Health ultimately backed off the second one, creating sort of a gray area. This is still the law that you need to go through a physician, but they don't seem to be enforcing that. And 23andMe's major competitor, Navigenics, actually maintains a physician on staff in order to rubber stamp all of the customer requests that come through. I don't really think that meets the spirit of what the state regulation has in mind. I don't know if 23andMe has a similar situation with a physician there to meet the physician requirement. But both of these companies and a third major competitor in Iceland are licensed by the state of California as clinical laboratories. But this is part of the reason why 23andMe has sponsored some legislation in the California legislature to try to clarify this situation as to what these companies are, how they should be treated in the eyes of the law, and how they should be regulated. And that this is really going to be a very interesting discussion. And I think the key component for a lot of customers, the major question is, these are my genes. They exist inside my cells. Is this something that I should have access to? Or do I need to go through a physician as a gatekeeper? From a public policy standpoint, We try not to deal with anecdotes. What could happen if a few people are misled? That the standard has to be very high from a public policy standpoint. You need to be able to say that the risks are identifiable and so great such that we must act in the interests of everybody in society. And the question is, where do we come down on that? How should these companies be regulated? Should customers have access to their own information? I think these are the things that are going to be debated in this panel and moving forward.
Absolutely. Just to answer that one question about 23andMe, how has 23andMe dealt with the question of whether a doctor needs to approve the testing.
Well, we didn't think the rubber stamping idea was such a great idea. So we've been in continuous discussions with the state of California, and as Daniel was saying, it is sort of a gray area right now. We do have a physician who sort of oversees our, you know, the laboratory side of what we're doing based in at our partner laboratory. So NGI, which is a division of LabCorp, which is CLIA certified, they have on their staff a qualified physician who is overseeing all of the testing that goes on there. So I think that's kind of the construct we're within right now. But we don't believe that a physician should have to order this for you. That's our
and
approach
so right
to this.
Now, if a consumer came in and said 23andMe, please give me my genome map, you don't have to ask.
No, you don't.
Who the doctor
no.
is. Okay,
right.
And
yeah.
you don't. Okay, fair enough.
Can I say something about this?
Yes, please.
I think that in a way there's a lot of appeal to saying it's your genetic information, you have a right to it, and nobody should have ability to stand between you and that information. But another way of looking at it, and it's complicated because it includes both medical and non-medical information in this test, but we regulate the practice of medicine. You also have a right to information about your cells and your cholesterol level and things that are going inside of your body. But if I decide that I want to offer you information without a license, or somebody wants to offer without a license as a practicing physician information, they can't just go out and buy an MRI machine and say, I'm going to do this. We allow the regulation of the practice of medicine, and you have to be licensed to do that in the state of California. And any test that's medical in character that's sufficiently complicated in California, it's not specifically about genetics, requires a physician order because that's a protection that's been put in place. Now, I recognize that most physicians don't know, or a lot of physicians at least, don't know enough about genetics, and so it's not clear that's really going to be a good solution, at least right now. But at the same time, the idea that the state has a right to regulate the practice of medicine, and that's, you know, diagnostics is part of the practice of medicine. So I think that the idea that the bar has to be that you have to first show harm to be able to regulate isn't true of how we regulate medicine.
I think I'm going to ask Daniel to jump in and address the policy issue.
So the question from a public policy standpoint is, are companies like 23andMe engaged in diagnostic testing? Is this a test, or is this just providing you information about what's inside all of your cells that you can then take to a medical professional and pursue medical decisions or lifestyle changes under the guidance of a physician? So that's the question. Are they testing for anything, or are they just providing you information that you can then go and ask your physician about to determine whether or not you want to seek additional treatment?
I think it's a little bit like what happens at the corner drugstore when they offer cholesterol testing, and then they encourage you to take that information to your physician who actually practices the medicine. So is the cholesterol testing a diagnostic test or not?
If it's simple enough, it doesn't have to. But if it's complex, then the state requires a physician.
Fair enough. Yes, Mark?
I just think that there's one thing that's useful to add to this, and that is, one of the interesting qualities of genetic information is that everyone shares it, so that if you find out about your genome and you tell other people about it, you actually also tell a lot about your kid's genome and your parents' genome, and they might not be parties in that decision. And actually, it goes on forever. You know, so in theory, if you find out something about your genome, you know, all your descendants, you know, will, in some sense, have some of their information revealed and found out. And so there's a kind of, how should one say it, eternal quality to this type of information.
Well, that's kind of a double-sided debate, though, because then on the flip side, we get that physicians say, well, family history's enough. You know, use your family history to predict your disease. Don't use your genes. Well, you know, that's the other side of the coin. Should you put a bag around your father with Alzheimer's so other people don't know that there's a risk for that in your family? I mean, that's kind of one way to look at that as well.
Fair enough. So one of the things we haven't gotten into is the whole question of, you were mentioning civil liberties, Daniel, and let's go ahead and launch into that now.
Well, I think there are a lot of questions about privacy, and particularly on the civil liberties side. The question is what information can the government get about your genomics by mining these private databases that companies like 23andMe are setting up? And it's an interesting question because this is potentially very useful to law enforcement from a forensic standpoint. Right now, let's say that there's a crime that takes place after this event outside this building. it would be, and there's some DNA left at the scene, it would be unconstitutional for the police to come and mine the Commonwealth Club's database, get the names of everybody that was in this room, and then go and physically seize DNA from everybody that attended this event. However, that's not necessarily true if everybody is using a service like 23andMe. Those constitutional protections don't apply. You don't need to show reasonable cause in order to get access to the information to mine the database. And the question is, should Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable seizure apply? Should they require a warrant in order to get genetic information? And I think this is something that needs to be addressed not just in personal genomics, but all technologies where you're storing private information about yourself on remote computers, that this applies for services like Gmail and Hotmail. The same thing applies. If the government doesn't require reasonable cause in order to access your emails through Gmail. You, in fact, give up your Fourth Amendment rights. You don't have the same protections on Google servers that you do on your own personal computer. So I think it raises a lot of questions, also perhaps from a public health standpoint. I hear some people in this room coughing. It's possible there could be an outbreak of H1N1 and the
swine
CDC,
flu.
Exactly, swine flu. And the CDC could very much want to know what portion of the population is more susceptible to infection from this virus so that they can preemptively go to your door and quarantine you. You could see why they would want to do this. There's the potential that they could mine private databases for this. There's also the potential that for national security reasons, I can imagine people at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency right now, these are the people that are paid to think about far out sorts of projects that can help our national defense and national security. I can imagine somebody at DARPA sitting there right now thinking, what do you think the genetic profile is of a potential terrorist? And if we can identify what the genetic profile is of somebody who has a given racial background and has a genetic predisposition to fanaticism, perhaps we can go and preemptively wiretap them or lock them up. These are the types of things that the government could do, and the government often goes to private companies to mine their databases because, you know, oftentimes it's more convenient than collecting the information themselves, which is part of the reason why the NSA enlisted AT&T in warrantless wiretapping, because AT&T had all of this information going through its infrastructure already. It was very convenient for the government to just go and demand that information directly from the private company. So I think these are the types of things that need to be addressed in legislation at the federal level. It's not really something we can do in the state of California, but these are things that we need to think about long term.
How much of this came into play, Linda, when you were first creating 23andMe, and how much of this is incorporated in your privacy policies?
Well, that is something that we thought long and hard about, of how do we protect the information as much as we can. There's the technical protections that you can put into place, and so, luckily we're here in the Valley and we have audit committees that come in and look at how we've set up our databases and our servers and everything. So I think we've put a lot of intelligence into the design of it, so preventing hacking and that sort of thing. But, you know, when you talk about the government coming in, and I think we saw an example of a company pushing back on that with Google. You know, I don't know when that happened, a couple years ago, where the federal government wanted to come in and look at their databases, and they said, wait, not so fast. And, you know, other companies didn't really give that pushback. So I do think as a society, with cloud computing becoming more and more prevalent in society, it was, you know, I was in at a meeting in January where they were just, you know, you had people from Salesforce and all these companies coming forward saying, everything's moving to the cloud. You know, we trust the grid for our getting our electricity and our power and everything. That's how computing power is really going to be put out into the cloud. And this is an issue that won't just be applicable to 23andMe, but I think as more and more of our information gets out onto the web, we're going to have to be dealing with this. And I think from a legislative perspective, that is where the federal level has to step up. And we have to demand our privacy, too, I think, as individuals. I think we're being empowered with more information all the time. It's our right and our duty, I think, as a society to demand that.
So 23andMe has, as a general policy, that it would push back. It
Absolutely.
Would try to preserve the information. As an ethicist, how much of this information do you think belongs in, say, the public domain? How much do we as a people have a right to this information about us as a general public?
Well, what's tough is that we've developed over time some standards for how to deal with privacy in the medical realm, and we now have some regulations at the federal level to create protections through HIPAA. So we have a regulatory structure that says that we have an obligation. It's not always perfect, and we know there are sometimes breaches, but there are obligations and a lot that's been put in place to try and maintain confidentiality of medical information. These companies exist in a little bit of a regulatory vacuum, and they're not covered by HIPAA. Yeah. Companies like 23andMe have voluntarily imposed very rigorous standards that meet those kinds of HIPAA standards. But because there's no regulation, there's a lot of variation across different kinds of companies, and they range from 23andMe to companies trying, you know, nutrigenomic companies trying to get you to buy supplements associated with really, really shoddy evidence, and who knows what kind of privacy protection some of these companies have in place. Again, in California, the cease and desist letters have been in place for some of those companies to stop them from operating here, but they're operating definitely in a lot of other states. So without that kind of some kind of a solution to that, there's a lot of variation, and you need to be very aware when you decide that you're signing up with a particular company of how they're handling this. And the American Society of Human Genetics has come up with some guidelines and standards for what they think every company that does this ought to meet in terms of being very explicit about their privacy standards. But again, not all companies meet that standard.
Mark, are we sometimes asking too much of the science?
Well, I mean, there's sort of two questions in terms of asking too much of the science. I mean, there's asking scientists to read too much into the genome right now and be able to actually tell you about your health. And I think there's also just in terms of asking too much of the science, sort of asking, you know, the scientists to keep things more secure and keep the information more separated than we might want it to be. I think that one of the things that's very, very important to realize about genomic information is that unlike some of the other type of information you might, say, put up onto a computer cloud, this information never is going to go away. I mean, when you know it, your children are going to have it on and on. And right now, we don't exactly know how to interpret genomic information, but 50 years from now, I'm sure we will. And what that means is that if this information is kind of uncovered and sent around all around the world and people kind of have it, it might seem kind of fun now and interesting, but 50 years from now, it might be kind of a hidden time bomb, you know, that you'll be able to look at that and read all sorts of interesting things into various people's families and descendants. And there's also this interesting issue, too, that since we're all related at some level, as more and more people's genomes are sequenced and more of this information is unearthed, it kind of becomes statistically possible to tell a lot about a person's genome, even if they're not sequenced. It's kind of like if there's 100 people in a room and 99 have their genome sequenced, you kind of know what that last person's genome is. And so I think there's a lot of interesting sort of technical issues with what's going to be happening in the future in relation to genomic information.
Okay.
Can I just add one minor point? But the point about the future, it's not just long, you know, far 50 years from now. One of the things that's very interesting for when people are making decisions about what they want to disclose publicly, Jim Watson, who had his genome sequenced and made his genome publicly available, as did Craig Venter, the first people who had their genome sequenced. But Watson decided that there were a few sequences, there were a few areas that he didn't want to know his results. For example, he didn't want to know his APOE4 results. He didn't want to know whether he was going to get Alzheimer's disease or was an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. And he didn't want that public, and I think he didn't even want to have that information himself. But the thing that's tricky is you put all that other information out there, and as the science keeps developing, there may very well be other associations with dementia and things that he wouldn't want to know or wouldn't want others to know that may become available. So again, things that you think right now are not problematic could turn out to be problematic because it's an area where so much is changing so rapidly.
I actually had two I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll just chime in for a second. And these sorts of questions are things that policymakers have thought about. And last year, Congress, I believe last year, passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which forbids employers and insurance companies from discriminating against you based on your genetic makeup. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned about privacy here. That just means there's an actual crime that can be committed, And you, as the consumer, should take responsibility for mitigating that risk, just as you do for identity theft. I suppose that the difference here, and the tricky issue for ethicists, as David said, is that unlike with identity theft, where if your Social Security number was stolen, as mine was, as well as 160,000 other UC former, current and former UC Berkeley students, I'm sure you heard about this data breach last week, you can put a fraud alert on your credit report, okay, but if it gets really bad, you can get a new Social Security number. That's not true with your genome. You can't file for a new genome. You can't apply for a new family history. This information does stay with you forever. And I think it's very important to be cognizant of that as a consumer, to pay attention to the privacy policies of the companies that you're doing business with. Just out of curiosity, I know a lot of people here use the internet. How many people actively read the privacy policies of the sites that they're visiting?
Only about half a dozen hands have gone up. Okay, so Linda, I think this begs a lot of different questions for you, but you would seem to want to jump in. Go ahead and address the point you wanted to make.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, if you look at a lot of new technologies when they first came out, when the car came out, it didn't have headrests, it didn't have seatbelts, it didn't have all these protections in place to really prevent. And a lot of people have died in car accidents, but that doesn't mean cars are bad. And I think we, you know, everything has a caveat, everything has a risk to it. And I think the internet's the same way. You know, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens because we have access to all this information, but we still choose to have that. And as a society, we come together and figure out, okay, what are the checks and balances we need to have in place? And that's exactly why we voluntarily went to the state of California and said, okay, the feds aren't stepping up here. And frankly, the Department of Health in California doesn't know a lot about genetics, but they're trying really hard, and we're working with them, and I think we are a very responsible company. So we're really kind of taking this step by step and being very responsible in the sense that we know this needs regulation that doesn't exist right now. So I think that is that's the headrest, that's the seatbelt we're trying to develop.
Let's let Mark make a quick point.
Yeah, I'll just add to her point. I mean, we've been talking all about the negative things about releasing genomic information. But of course, the positive thing of doing that is that if we have lots of people's genomes and we can mine them, potentially we can find out a lot of useful medical information, and we'll be able to do lots of really amazing things for medicine in the future. And that's only going to be possible if, to some degree, people allow their genetic information to be unveiled and for it to be correlated with their phenotype and for medical research to progress. And so I think the conundrum is, you know, how can you allow society to do that for populations as a whole and to kind of do this large-scale mining, but yet still protect the privacy of all the individual people? And this is a very difficult kind of information type challenge.
But I think the corollary to that is that is it ethical to do genetics research and not give the genetic information back to the individual it came from? And that's, you know, the genetics and public policy group at Johns Hopkins did a survey, and they asked people, if you were part of research and your genetic data has been generated, do you think you have a right to access that? And overwhelmingly, people said, not only should I, it's unethical for me to not have access to that information. Whereas, you know, the construct right now is you give over your sample and they say, thank you very much. You're a human subject. You're not necessarily a person. Thank you. And now go away. We don't want to have any, we want a firewall between the research community and the patient and the public. And we just think that's wrong. We think you deserve to have this information. It's yours.
Yeah, but you have to also weigh whether or not the information has any value or is likely to be helpful or harmful. So what's happened in terms of guidelines in this area that have been emerging, the stance of just creating a firewall seems clearly problematic, because some of that information actually could be valuable and useful, and it might even be dangerous and irresponsible not to give it to them.
Right.
So I think creating that firewall and saying in principle you won't be recontacted is highly problematic, and I think there's an emerging consensus that that won't work. You have to have mechanisms built in and find ways of communicating in the informed consent process that it's at least possible that recontacting will take place. But you have to distinguish between those things where you're obligated even to recontact, areas where it's permissible but not obligatory, but also areas where it's just too preliminary and too soon. Giving people information that has no value or we can't interpret it is not clearly a value, and it's not clear to me that, especially if in the context of research, that that's something that people have a right to, or that it's responsible to do that.
Which also begs the question of how long 23andMe feels it is responsible for educating the consumer on the meaning of the information that you've given them. Is it indefinite?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously as long as we can stay in business as a company, that's our goal, is that we expect to have a long-term relationship with all of our customers. And that's partly why we, you know, the intention we have of doing the research. So we're, the second phase of our platform was the introduction of the ability to put surveys out. And now our customer base, not only are they armed with their genetic information, but now they can tell us more based on these surveys we're creating about their phenotype. You know, what color are your eyes? What, do you have curly hair, straight hair? Are you left or right-handed? All of these bits of information, but then also eventually we're going to start moving more into what diseases have you had, what drugs can you take, what bad reactions have you had to things. And not only that, but there's a lot of information that we walk around with that we don't, that never makes it into our medical record. You know, if you've got a flare with rheumatoid arthritis, you maybe pop some more of your, you know, your painkillers, and oh, I had another migraine, or I had this, or I had the other thing. But how often do you really call your doctor, and how much do we really capture that information in a meaningful way that could really inform genetics research? So that's what we're really hoping to tap into, is all of this information. We think people are pretty smart, you know, and when we talk to the medical community, they tend to differ with that, where they think that people can't possibly self-report this information. But we do think there is some data that we can gather very effectively.
But when I, as a consumer, come to 23andMe and give you, do I give you permission to share my information in blind studies that don't identify me as an individual?
Not to share it outside the company. We do the research internally. So we keep all that information. We do it sort of on the back end. Our research group has access to the data without your identifiers on it.
Then what happens to that information, to that research?
We'll publish it. We'll publish papers, and you'll get attribution that you were part of a study, so hopefully that will show up in the paper as well.
Ooh, okay. One of the things we haven't addressed is that there have been quite a bit of patenting of the human genome. The ACLU filed suit against Myriad Genetics, I think you were telling me before the program, regarding the BRCA gene, the breast cancer gene. How is this going to impact 23andMe moving forward if we have these patents that basically say you can't tell people about their own breast cancer gene, you can't tell people about their Alzheimer's gene, you can't tell them about different aspects of their own genomic map because it's already patented?
Yeah, and I think that's why it's being challenged now, because now we're seeing the advent of people having access to a lot of information across all of their genes. And I think people say it's been 20% of the genome has been patented now. You can see in not too far in the future when you won't be able to learn a lot about your genome because you're, you know, like a company like 23andMe, we'd have to go license every bit from all these different organizations. And a lot of them are universities. It's not all companies. A lot of universities did a land grab and grabbed a lot of the intellectual property that's being discovered through our tax dollars, which we also think is a little bit dubious. But, you know, the problem will be that companies like 23andMe just won't be able to afford to do all of that licensing, and we won't be able to gain access to a broad set of our information because of that.
Daniel, what can we do on a public policy level to address some of these issues?
So specifically the patenting issues, I think there are a lot of questions about whether genes should ever be patented in the first place. But the fact is they have been, and now there are a lot of consequences to that. Is it okay if I go back to a second?
Yes, please do.
I think there are some points that got by us about whether we're still in such early stages of this research that patients shouldn't have access to the information because they can't, I guess, handle the truth is the argument put forward by the medical community that the information is just far too complicated. They can't possibly deal with it. I wanted to bring a study from 1961 from the Journal of the American Medical Association that did a poll of physicians asking, do you inform your patients if they have cancer? And 90% of physicians in 1961 said no, that cancer was just far too complicated, the research was far too early, and customers couldn't possibly handle this information. And you know, I'll ask Mark, is cancer any less complex now than it was in 1961?
I don't think that's changed.
That's not fair. The 61, it was a very paternalistic period. People had views about what information people handle. The argument here isn't that people can't understand or handle it. The geneticists can't. We don't understand it. The 23andMe doesn't understand it. The geneticists. We're talking about information that's not interpretable or doesn't mean anything. And there's a difference between saying we think it's just very complicated and saying there are often results and often tests, and especially when you're doing research, not necessarily the sorts of things that 23andMe in fact doesn't offer commercially, because that's what you're talking about, is returning research results. If you have something where you can show there's a copy number variation or a SNP where we don't have a genome-wide association study validly associating it with the disease. All we know is that there's a variation. That's all we know about it. We don't know what it means. Nobody knows what it means. What does it mean to say people have a right to know this? You have a right to know that you have a deletion, that we have no idea what it means. We have no idea what it's associated with.
Mark,
that,
go ahead.
That doesn't mean anything.
No, but I think that I have to come back to this issue of the relatedness of genetic information. I think that's really what changes this very much. And I think one way of getting an analogy of this is you might say, well, I have total rights to everything in my email box, you know, and that's mine, okay? And I go to some company and maybe they do some analysis and I can just do whatever I want with it. I'm just going to put it up on the web. But what if all those people who sent you messages and suddenly, you know, they're going to find everything they sent you, they thought they sent you in confidence, suddenly exposed? And I think that's the same type of thing that happens with genetic information. If I go and, you know, get all this kind of nonsensical information about myself and I have it, I can potentially compromise the privacy of, you know, my parents, children, all sorts of relatives who maybe didn't participate in that consent. And I think the other issue that is just very, very important to realize is that right now I think a lot of this stuff is just kind of frankly fun, and it's fun to talk about, and it's interesting, but we don't know what it all means. And it might turn out that, oh, this particular region of the genome where I have a particular copy number variant, 10 years from now, they're going to show that this is related to some bizarre form of mental disability or something, or some strange behavior pattern. And, you know, I'm going to be very, you know, self-conscious when I find out that, oh, I've just told everyone about this and it's just kind of fun. Oh, I have this region missing or something like that. And actually, one of the things they say in medical research is you're not supposed to actually do research on yourselves or something like that for the exact reason that a lot of times you're in a very strange position when you're doing that type of thing. And so I think this information...
Greg Venter did.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's potentially very powerful, and I don't think we fully understand the implications. That doesn't mean it's not a good thing to unearth it, but I think we have to think about it a bit.
We're on a wonderful roll here, and I don't want to stop it, but in a couple of minutes we're going to be asking for questions from the audience, so if you want to start lining up at the mics on either side, now would be a good time. Linda, I saw you jump forward a couple of times. Was there something you wanted to add to that?
Well, going back to the point of when are we ready to get access to this information? When is the right time? You know, it's sort of like you can look at cholesterol. We don't know what the hell's going on with cholesterol, but people get their cholesterol numbers all the time. So when is it perfect information? And it's that's the thing we're battling, is that there's never going to be the right time. And really what this is about is let's get people at least educated about genetics, get them understanding what relative risks are, you know, what are odds ratios. And Esther Dyson on our board has a great example of using, you know, looking at statistics. And if anybody tries to sit down and read a book about statistics, we'll all fall asleep in 2 minutes. But talk about baseball and statistics, it changes everything. People can suddenly talk about batting averages, RBIs. They forget that the statistics fades to the background. It's the application. The same, I think, is going to be true of genetics, where you suddenly, because it impacts you personally, you pay way more attention to it. And I think people learning under the rubric of their own genomes is it's a new model, and I think it will change how we understand these things.
Now, David, you had said earlier that you seemed rather skeptical. You thought perhaps people shouldn't be doing it at this stage.
Well, I think it's early. I'm not sure I want to go quite that far, but I would say that one of the things that's really important is that we do collect data about these kinds of questions. So I think we shouldn't assume that we know that there are risks and we know there's potential harms. So what we need to know is how are people doing this? And there are some efforts to do this. There's a not-for-profit that's doing some similar things to 23andMe called Coriel that's doing it as a research project. So they'll give you this information, but in exchange for that, they get to study how do people use this information? Does it have an impact? So we can start to address the question about whether or not, if you're thinking about this, these are safe and effective, like any other sort of thing that we want to offer for health benefits. And I think some of the better companies, 23andMe, Navigenics, are also starting to go down that path of starting to try and engage in research to find out what the actual impact is. But not all companies are doing that.
Okay. We are going to be moving on to audience questions. And just as a reminder, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum. And tonight we are hosting a panel on personal genomic testing. I am Janet Ray Dupree. I'm the moderator. And we are currently in discussion with Linda Avey, who is the co-founder of 23andMe, Daniel Ballin, who is a senior fellow, technology studies at the Pacific Research Institute, David Magnus, associate professor and director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University's School of Medicine, and Mark Gerstein, who is the Albert Williams Professor of Biomedical Informatics, Molecular Biophysics, Biochemistry, and Computer Science at Yale University. I would like to, I'm going to start over here on the right-hand side. Please, ma'am, what is your question?
Would you be kind enough to raise your hand if you, either any of you, have had your gnomes tested?
I think the only person who is admitting to having had her genome map actually done is Linda, whose company does that.
Second question: What did you learn that was either negative or helpful, or what did you learn?
That's a good question.
Well, one of the things, I've been going to dermatologists pretty much my whole life, and I've always had kind of these weird rashes that pop up, and sometimes the doctor will say it's eczema, sometimes psoriasis, sometimes you're allergic. There's never been a really clear answer, and for me personally, I did see that one of the reports that we have is on psoriasis, and I am at pretty elevated risk for psoriasis. So I think that helped at least maybe identify why it is that I get these things. And but, you know, I didn't have a lot of dramatic learnings because I'm very lucky genetically, maybe. I've got both of my grandmothers both lived to 100. My great-grandmother lived to 101. So I think I'm just very lucky in that sense. But, you know, I've learned my kids, all three of my children were genotyped. And one thing with my fraternal twins is I found out in their HLA region, which is the part of the genome where we inherit our immune systems, they are 100% identical, even though they're not identical twins. That's interesting information if they were in a position where they might need to donate an organ to each other or something along that line. So we're starting to see glimpses of that as we start to peel back more and more of the layers of the genome of how can we use this information going forward. And one of the other areas that we're very interested in is in pharmacogenetics. And I found out that I'm not sensitive to warfarin, which is good information for me to have armed if I ever have a stroke or have a problem where I have to go on basically rat poison to thin my blood out. I can tell my doctor that it doesn't look like I'm at increased risk for sensitivity to that drug, whereas I was on a panel last week with a gentleman, Clayton Christensen, who's a professor at Harvard. He's a big guy, 6'5", he had a stroke caused by a clot. And his doctors kind of gauged his level of warfarin based kind of on his size. They kind of do a little bit of one of these, like, okay, we think we should put you at this dose. Well, he's also a type 1 diabetic, and he was pricking his finger to test his glucose levels, and the blood would just come spouting out of his finger. No. So he had this kind of double thing going on, but we could see that in his genome. And that's information that's very informative when you're encountering these situations.
So are there medical doctors in practice who are knowledgeable in an interpretation, which you obviously are individually, but
we're getting there. You know, there are a lot of organizations that we're talking to, Stanford being one of them, that I think they're very interested in providing programs back to their clinicians in order to get them up to speed on this, because we're not the only company. There are a lot of companies starting to offer these things now.
David, would you like to address the bioethics of a physician actually giving information about the genome mapping that had been done?
Yeah, so there's some written about it. One of the problems is that it's also we have to distinguish between the kinds of information, the stuff that's really useful, and that most of that's going to be in the future. There's some useful information now, but more of that is something we hope in the future, and we have to get our physicians ready to be able to provide that information. In the interim, where we have some information, a little that's useful, and a lot that's not very helpful and not very useful, we're really more worried about wasting physicians' time, because the time of physicians, as everybody knows, they've got a short little period of time. It's very hard. And if everybody who does this goes to their physicians for information, as a lot of these websites say you should, it's going to be an awful lot of time going to physicians and having them try and explain why this information really doesn't really tell you very much. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that's a real problem.
Can I just chime in for one second?
Yes.
So as Linda said, she's not the only company, and that's not the only business model. There are other companies that are offering more of a full-service experience,
right,
where you'll walk in, they'll test your genome or scan your genome, and you'll have a consultation with a physician or a genetic counselor.
Right.
Okay. And we have a question over here on the left-hand side.
I hear a lot of skepticism around the research side.
Skepticism around?
The research side, Linda was talking about doing back research on the back end. Haven't we done this for a long time before with longitudinal, large-scale studies. They don't use genetics, but they do use other biomarkers. Why is this different?
Well, are you referring to the Framingham study
or some of these?
Well, they really didn't have the genetic component to it, so that I think that was one of the big differences, where they just didn't have the tools. You know, the Framingham study started 60 years ago, so they hadn't even sequenced the genome yet. So,
but it brings up the same ethical questions, doesn't it?
That's true.
And
yeah,
they figured it out then. So why are we revisiting?
Oh, I don't think they figured out the ethics at that time.
The genetics, yeah, that just yeah. And that I think you guys have, you know, really brought that up well. That this is different. I mean, genetic information has a different sensitivity to it that I think that's, as a society, we do need to have a discussion about how we handle it.
Yeah. And over here on the right-hand side, another question from the audience.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm wondering if the social utility of genomic testing is completely within the realm of medicine, or what sorts of useful or interesting information is involved in the genetic testing process that's non-medical in nature.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot that's not non-medical, a lot.
But it's even the stuff that we kind of think when you hear about it on first blush of whether or not it's medical. You know, lactose intolerance that's arguable whether that's medical. You can't drink milk, but, you know, that affects your health and that affects how you feel. And we've even have a discussion going in 23andMe about earwax, about evolutionarily maybe there's some reason why some of us have dry earwax and some have wet earwax, and maybe that's something that was positively selected for in certain populations, and we don't really know. So that's the part where it's just fascinating to see people starting to speculate. What does this mean? And whether or not it has a medical implication is really yet to be determined.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I do think that there's going to be a lot of, you know, potentially very fun things that you can do with genetic information, and I think one of the most interesting things is sports. You know, you can imagine kind of the baseball cards of the future, you know, having the players' genomes on them. And I think will be quite interesting. You know what I'm saying? Or you take the runners in the Boston Marathon, the people who do really well, and you could look at their genotype and right away. And so I think there'll be a lot of very fun things like that.
Brings whole new meanings to the term soccer, Mom.
I'll also chime in that it probably won't surprise you that there are already companies that are starting to use this for dating purposes to try to figure out what the genetics of attraction might be.
It had to happen. Yes, your question.
I wanted to ask you about the issue of privacy, because so much of this personal genomics, especially 23andMe company, is so much based in the discourse of Web 2.0. Because at the beginning, wasn't there like the, I don't know if you coined it or someone else coined it, but it's like Facebook for your genes, 23andMe.
I wish.
And but the thing is, it's in Web 2.0, you have this participatory discourse and you ask people to participate. And then there is a lot of, seems to be institutional pushback against, well, but people are sharing this information and something bad is going to happen. We need to regulate privacy. And isn't there a way, isn't that what it's going toward is a way of reconceptualizing what privacy actually means? Isn't it not possible to install the standards of privacy that were very much institutionally based into something like Web 2.0 stuff or Web 3.0?
So let's jump in on that one.
Please, I can certainly say. I mean, I do think that this personal genomics is very much part of this kind of, you know, Web 2.0 phenomena of sharing information. And I think that in some sense it's the ultimate form of that. I mean, it's the ultimate form of information sharing. And I think some of the problems that we're seeing now with personal genomics actually potentially are problems that people haven't fully realized with Web 2.0. I mean, sharing lots of pictures of yourself or your location and so forth is sometimes a little more problematical in the long term than, you know, people might realize when they're doing it. And I do think that we're going to you know, have to redefine notions of privacy and acceptability, you know, going into the future with all this information sharing.
And but one thing I think is that we've seen that is remarkable is, you know, mental illness has always had such a stigma, and people, my mom's mom had bipolar disorder, and they just never talked about it. They lived in a small town, and it was just terrible, and nobody talked about it. And I told my mom the other day there's a blogger in Philly who blogs about her bipolar, and she goes out there and says, "I'm feeling great today," and the next day I'm feeling terrible, and she's just out in the open about it, and everybody's like, "Oh, so big deal, she's got bipolar." And I think that's kind of what your point may be, that we have a different sensitivity to privacy because there are stigmas that in previous generations that we just don't have anymore, and we're not as concerned about these things. And I do think there's a big shift. I have a son who's a junior at Berkeley, and he's you know, privacy. You know, they're out on Facebook. They're doing all these things.
Is he one of my students? I have 250 students, and they don't care. It's a different
yeah.
We're going to have to limit it to one question.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's still an empirical question, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Are there going to be people who are right now feeling comfortable sharing, but when they see all the implications, they're going to be nervous about it? Or is it really a generational shift where we really are facing a group of people? And again, we can start to empirically explore this question.
But
the new generation where they just don't care.
So a little like getting a tattoo. Are you going to regret it later?
Yeah, we just don't know.
Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe you could comment on the relationship between genetic testing programs that are currently being used for either rare genetic diseases or for family planning, and kind of how that relates to what 23andMe is doing, or kind of just, it seems kind of like an evolution of genetic testing and how it's being used. And
well, this is, you know, this is an interesting debate that we do believe, you know, because we are enabling people with information that, you know, maybe they want to go into their you know, their fertility doc and say, hey, you know, we're doing PGD, which is the pre-implantation genetic diagnostics, and, you know, how much of that information really should be used for selection purposes. It opens up a whole new can of worms that we're, you know, we want to be part of this debate, and as a company where we see ourselves fitting is we try to be as accurate and as true to the science as we can be about what do these genetic markers actually mean. But then where these fertility doctors take this information and enable their patients as a couple coming in saying, hey, doc, we've got our 23andMe data. We want a baby with blue eyes and this, that, and the other thing. Right. That moves this into a whole new space where we really want to be, you know, arm in arm with the ethicists.
Yes. Yes. Regulations and ethical debates kind of transfer from one.
So I'll just say that's the wrong way to do it. If you're trying to do family planning, whether it's with PGD or other sorts of things, and you really want to have genetic testing as part of that process, either testing yourselves before you have a child, or if you want to do prenatal testing, which 23andMe doesn't allow, or it's not possible right now. If you want to do something like that, there are clinical genetics is a part of medicine, and there are several reasons why they're very, very different. The kinds of tests that have certain clinical standards that you need medically to be able to do that, and some of the tests that you would want to have are not available because they're just looking at what we were talking about before, SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and for some of the kinds of testings you need for clinical genetic purposes for family planning would not be included that you would want on a standard panel, and there are standard panels that exist for those kinds of things. And you also would need to have a genetic counselor to help work with you, and some companies have that, but not all. You really have to go through a clinical genetic testing services through your physician if that's the explicit goal for what you want. It would be, I think, a problem if we found that families who really need clinical services decide to send. It'd be like self-medicating yourself by looking up information on the web instead of going to your physician. That would be, I think, a real problem.
Ooh, yeah. Okay.
Hi. I'm just curious. I have like a two-part question. The first question deals with, I guess,
if you can kind of narrow it down to just the one question.
Just the
that'd
one
be
question.
Great.
Okay. The first question is healthcare providers. Where do they weigh in on this debate on genetic testing? I can see, on one hand, if your testing results got into the hand of a insurance provider, that could be either a plus or minus for you, depending on where the science is. You could either say my premiums should be reduced because I'm not at risk for certain diseases, or my insurance premiums are going to go through the roof. And given the fact of the healthcare crisis here today and how many people now are an individual, you know, they don't have corporate insurance to cover them, I'm just curious as to what's the feedback you're hearing from healthcare insurance providers, or where do they play in this debate here?
Well, they're very, you know, obviously they see this field evolving, and, you know, I think they're running a little scared because, you know, most insurance individuals we talk to at these companies, they get beat up so bad, and they're really, you know, honestly, they're really good people, and they're trying to do the right thing. But, you know, I think the other thing that we have to look at, because we hear Obama and everybody talking about we have to change healthcare, we've got a lower cost, what are we going to do? And I think part of it is that we have to take ownership of our own health. We can't always expect the system just to catch us every time we fall. And if we have predispositions for certain things like type 2 diabetes, we should keep our weight down. We should eat right and eat well. And if we don't, is that the insurance company's now onus? Is the onus on them to catch us and say, okay, we're going to pay for everything because you didn't take the steps you should? And, you know, corporates, companies are, like Safeway is a great example of a company that's really incentivizing their employees to be healthy. And they have, you pay in at the beginning of the year, and then if you say, I'm going to lower my BMI and I'm going to quit smoking, at the end of the year, if you can prove that, it's easy with BMI, and they actually swab your cheek, they give you a rebate. You get money back. So I think positive incentives are something that I think the insurance companies will probably come up with. That if you hold up your end of the bargain, then your premiums will stay the same. If you don't, by golly, you got to pay for that.
But I'm sure there are a number of ethical issues that David can educate us on.
This is also very future-directed, so just coming back to the same point, there's a small number of genes right now for which companies want to have that information and might be able to act on it. And although GINA does offer protection, some limited protections for health care insurance, it doesn't offer any protection for disability insurance or life insurance. Mm-hmm. So there is a small number. But again, for the vast majority of things, you use type 2 diabetes as an example. I mean, the truth is right now that the odds ratios are so low, the amount of variance that they explain, it's got no actuarial value for the insurance company. Family history is vastly, vastly more predictive than all the type 2 diabetes genes that have been identified so far, put together.
We have just enough time.
By an order of magnitude.
We have just enough time for one last question. Please, go ahead.
One of the paper I did for my college is on the topic free will versus determinism. So my question is, by knowing this results, would that what kind of psychological effects on that person's motivation to achieve or to, you know, think outside the box and accomplish and say, I believe I can do better than what was given to me, what I was born with? Mm-hmm. Very quickly, my second question is that from the movie with Tom Cruise, Minority Report, how would the government actually use this to incriminate people, saying that because it shows that they have the predisposition of being a violent person, that let's bar him from the society to prevent him doing any harm? So.
Well, we're not at that stage yet genetically, but go ahead.
No. So actually, one of the things we have on our website is a segment called Variations, and one of the things we like to celebrate is human diversity and human passion for things. And there's a professional basketball player. He's 5'2", and, you know, his genetics, probably his parents would have said, even if they had his genome when he was little, that, you know, you may not want to do this. But because of his passion and because of his drive and his desire to play this sport, he was able to overcome his stature and become a pro player. And so we like to celebrate that, to say, and frankly, you know, people always bring up the movie, ooh, Gattaca, you know, you guys are Gattaca. But actually the message in that movie was very positive, that the guy shot him, he went to the moon or wherever he was going. He was able to go because he really, really wanted to do that. And he did everything within his human ability to overcome what looked like might be lurking in his genes. So I think that is a message that as a company we like to put out there, that there's more to us than just our genetics. It's not always deterministic. And we're very complicated beings that have a lot of abilities to go beyond.
That's amazing. Yeah. David, please.
I was going to say, if anything, we've learned anything from genetics is it's so much more complicated than we thought it was going to be. That in a way, some of the worries, I mean, I know back in the 90s when I was at a lot of meetings with other philosophers worrying about these kinds of issues, most of the things we were concerned about eugenics and all this power that we were going to have, it's going to be a lot harder and a lot more complicated than that. So in a way, in terms of people who want to find room for free will, the science has actually been on their side.
And I think that's an excellent way to close out the evening. This has been a fabulous presentation. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for a wonderful overview. And now this meeting of InForum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.